Our guest this hour has been doing some fascinating work. He is joining us by phone from Tucson, Arizona, but he lives in England. And maybe you heard me give you this story, but he and a fellow astronomer were at Oxford University, and they went to a pub across the street to, you know, relax after a long day's work, and they came up with this idea, which has really taken off. And the idea was to have members of the public assist in classifying over 60 million galaxies. The project is called the Galaxy Zoo. It is an online astronomy project, and our guest this hour is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Physics at the University of Oxford and a junior research fellow at Somerville College. His research grew out of work which centered on the application of astrochemical models of star formation to galaxies beyond the Milky Way. Don't you love this stuff? He's also principal investigator for this project that we're going to be talking about. He's involved in popular science, most familiarly as co-presenter on the nearly 50-year-old Sky at Night program. Chrissy and I were watching this yesterday alongside Sir Patrick Moore, and also as a co-author of Bang, which was included on the long list for the 2007 Royal Society Book Prize. He also has a regular column on observing the night sky in the Times, and so we can talk about that as well, although there's plenty to talk about with all of these galaxies. I just wanted to remind you, and we're going to put this on our... I'm so struck by this beautiful picture. We'll put this on our Facebook page, too. Hubble, right before we went off the air yesterday, I thought the timing was exquisite, released a picture yesterday of a spiral galaxy that's spinning like a wheel. It lies some 320 million light years away in the coma cluster of 1,000 galaxies, and one light year is about 5.9 trillion miles. There's a picture of this, and it's absolutely beautiful. So if you want to go to our Facebook page after the show so we have time to put it up, please do that. At any rate, let's get on to the program and to our guest. And Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for the long and embarrassing introduction. It's great to be here.
You were embarrassed?
Well, you're reading out my life's work there. But you're right that there's plenty to talk about.
Yeah, there is. And I only read half of your life's work, so I could have really embarrassed you
We'll save the juicy stuff for later,
So this really was an idea. Tell me about this. I love how ideas get sprung. But you were just talking after work about...
To solve, one of those everyday problems that people face, which, many people in their lives find they have too many images of galaxies. I don't know whether you've experienced this, but it's something that astronomers have been struggling with. In the old days, before modern cameras and modern telescopes, we were lucky to get images of 50 or 60 galaxies. You could spend your whole career looking in detail at galaxies like the one you just mentioned that Hubble took an image of. But these days, we could do better than that. And there was a robotic telescope in New Mexico called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey that had imaged a million galaxies.
Wow.
So this is wonderful. It's much less than 1% of our entire observable universe, but it's enough to get a real handle on what's going on. But there's a catch, because if you want to get to know these galaxies properly, you've got to look at them. You can get so far with computers, but there's no substitute for looking at a galaxy and determining what shape it is. So the kind of questions we were asking were about whether these were beautiful galaxies with spiral arms or whether these were just big balls of stars that we call ellipticals. And so before I arrived in Oxford, the astronomers there had, this is probably 2006, something like that, had taken the age-old route of solving an academic problem by throwing a student at it. And the poor student was called Kevin Savinsky. He's now at Yale, having got as far away from the people who forced him to do this as possible. But they told him to sit and look through 50,000 of these images. So he spent a couple of weeks doing nothing but looking at galaxies and classifying them. And when I turned up, I was talking to Kevin, and to his horror, we realized that he needed to do the other 950,000 in the survey. Without those, then we couldn't answer the questions we were trying to ask, and maybe we'll talk a bit about them later. So we did what any self-respecting British academics would do and went to the pub to consider this problem. and we realized that the solution wasn't to make Kevin work harder, but to recruit many more people via the internet and try and get the whole world to classify galaxies, because if you split the task up, it doesn't look so bad. And so that was the idea, and a few months later, Galaxy Zoo was born.
Isn't that something? Now, tell me how many. I didn't quite get you. You're looking at a million galaxies, but there are how many galaxies, or do we
in our
don't
observable universe, we think there are 100 billion.
100 billion so, galaxies?
Yeah, and each one of those has 100 billion stars, roughly. So there are about as many stars in the universe as there are grains of sand on the Earth. You can argue either way. I haven't counted grains of sand. Maybe we'll do that later.
as long as you ever have enough students.
So it sounds pathetic, doesn't it, that we're only looking at a million?
No, it sounds impressive. Million. It's impressive.
But it's not actually too bad either. It's about the same proportion as if you do an opinion poll around election time in the U.S., pollsters will typically call maybe 800 or 1,000 people. So that fraction of the U.S. population is about the fraction of galaxies that we have. And so we're doing it's a reasonable sample, and we can draw conclusions about the universe from our million galaxies.
Now, are people naming these galaxies, or do they already have names?
Astronomers shouldn't be allowed to name anything. it's a very strange subject, because I think lots of us get drawn into it because of the romance of looking up at the night sky. And then we give these galaxies names like, well, the one that you were talking about from Hubble goes by the romantic name of NGC 4911.
That's great.
And the galaxies we have go by these long telephone numbers, 587743, whatever it is. And a few special ones get names once they become famous. And in fact, some of our volunteers have managed to find objects that are so unusual that they've been named after the volunteers.
Now, you say that we used to be able to look at only 50 or 60. Can you tell me about the technology that has advanced that allows us to look beyond via a computer?
Sure. Well, computers are part of it because we can handle the data. But actually, the thing that made the biggest difference is something you're very familiar with, which is a digital camera, just like the one you've probably got in your cell phone or the little digital cameras that people carry around. That technology, the chips that sit in those cameras, was first developed for astronomy. So it's one of the great side benefits of doing astronomy in the last 30 years is that we've invented these amazing electronic cameras. And that means that what you used to have to do, if you wanted to do a deep survey of the sky, was you'd get these big photographic plates. They're about the size, maybe a couple of feet square. And you'd put this at the bottom of the telescope. But to get a good, deep image of a galaxy, you might spend 8 or 9 hours just tracking the galaxy across the sky and allowing its light to fall onto the plate, leaving the shutter open, essentially. But with an electronic camera, the Sloan survey devoted only a couple of minutes to each galaxy. And so it's that's allowed us to speed up the speed at which we're surveying. I mean, I'm actually in Tucson at the minute at a meeting of a collaboration that's building a telescope called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, LSST, and that's going to scan the entire sky every 3 nights. And the amount of data we're going to get from that is actually truly frightening.
Ooh. So you were looking for volunteers, and holy Toledo, did you get volunteers? Your system crashed because so many people signed up.
It actually caught fire.
It caught fire.
Worse than that. So we launched it on the BBC. This is July 2007, I guess. And, I thought if we were lucky, we'd get a few hundred people. And we thought it would take 5 years to do a first look at all the galaxies. And then I started getting emails telling me that the project wasn't working. And then I looked and I realized that I had 30,000 emails a couple of hours after launch, almost all of them telling me that the server was down. And what happened was over in a basement in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University, where our computing lived, the server had actually caught fire
and had
dropped offline. So they got woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning their time. And told that their computers were offline, and unbelievably, they fixed it and got us back online. And within about a day, we were doing 70,000 classifications an hour between a huge number of volunteers. And 3 years later, we've had 300,000 people take part And we've had about 150 million classifications of galaxies.
Isn't that remarkable?
It's fantastic.
And some of these people get together, don't they?
They do. In fact, there's a meeting in back in Oxford in a couple of weeks' time. So, yeah, people have started meeting up. They meet, of course, online. And what's interesting about that is that they're beginning to do more of our work for us. So, you know, the initial task is very simple. Anyone, and I hope most of your listeners will do this, you can go to galaxyzoo.org and answer simple questions about the galaxies. But some of the people on the forum and some of the people who meet up have begun to do some really quite serious science. And it's got to the point where instead of just getting an email from them saying, I don't know what this object is, which happens quite often, I'm now getting emails that say, OK, well, we found 200 of these objects. They have the following characteristics. And you know, here's all the information you need. Now tell us what these things are. And this has happened again and again.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic.
What are those objects that they're...
Oh, well, my favorite recent example are these things called the Galaxy Zoo peas. So they're called peas after the vegetables because they're small, round, and green.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't look like much, but people started spotting them in the background of images. And they have a very distinctive color, which tells us something about how their light's generated. And it turns out that these are incredibly efficient factories for new stars. They're small galaxies. They're about a tenth the size of the Milky Way, so maybe 10 billion stars, not 100 billion. They live in the dark corners of the universe. They tend to live in places where there aren't many other galaxies. But for some reason, and we don't understand this yet, they've decided that right now they're going to convert all their gas into stars. And no one knew they were out there. No one had realized that they were a distinctive group of galaxies. Until people on Galaxy Zoo noticed that they looked different and started collecting them.
Huh. And I know you've expanded beyond classifying galaxies, that you're looking at the moon now and you're looking at animal behavior and...
Oh, well, we're getting there, yeah. So one other thing that happened was I started getting phone calls from scientists, all sorts of scientists, that said, you know, well, this works for Galaxy Zoo, so that's great, but I've got this set of data. Do you think people would be interested in helping me out? And so what we've done is we've tried to create a whole set of these projects. And so, as you mentioned, I mean, one place where there's too much data is in biology, because cameras have become cheap there too. So whereas you used to go and send your PhD student into the field to sit and watch, I don't know, crows in New Zealand is one example, and then they'd come back and write up their experiences. Now you can pepper the forest with webcams, but you still need people to have a look and see what's going on. So we're working on projects like that. One that's live now is Moon Zoo, named after Galaxy Zoo, of course, and we get this wonderful data set from NASA, from their Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and you can see things on the moon that are 30, 40 centimeters across. And so by looking at these images, we can tell the story of the moon in immense detail. But we need people to take a look. We don't have enough scientists in the world to look at the moon in this detail. So we need people. And they're finding all sorts of interesting things.
Mm. And tell me again, how do people sign up for that? Give me that website.
They just go to one of our websites. So they can either go to moonzoo.org, or we call this collection of projects, we call this the Zooniverse. So you can go to zooniverse.org or just Google us. But all of these projects are online, and none of them require much of a kickstart. You know, I know there are six-year-olds taking part in Galaxy Zoo, so this really is science that anyone can do, and it will make a difference to what we know about the universe.
Zooniverse.org. Let's welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them momentarily. Chris Lintott is our guest, co-founder of the Galaxy Zoo, co-author of Bang, the Complete History of the Universe. He is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Physics at the University of Oxford, and he is also involved in popular science. Maybe some of you have lived in England. So he's co-presenter of the show on BBC, Sky at Night, which has been around for 50 years, and he has a regular column, on observing the night sky in the Times. 800-486-8655 is the number, and the email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we start taking your phone calls. Alan is our first caller from Viroqua. Hi, Alan.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Hey, I really enjoy this program, and it's a terrific topic, and I've already got Zooniverse up on my laptop.
Great.
Fantastic.
So thank you very much for that. I start my day, I'm not any kind of an astronomer or anything like that, but I start my day every day with astronomy picture of the day. And have been fascinated by all those pictures of those galaxies. But the thing that drives me crazy is we look at the universe, and, of course, we're looking into the past.
Mm.
Has anybody out there put a model forward based on trajectories of certain large-scale parts of the universe? And can we see what they think it looks like today?
Okay. This is always one of the most amazing things about astronomy, that we actually get to see the past, but it's also something that's quite hard to wrap your head around. So, as you know, by the sound of things, you know, light takes time to reach us. And in fact, in Galaxy Zoo, we're now using Hubble to look deeper into the universe, so we can see what the universe looked like a few billion years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
And we could use that to try and understand what's happening. I mean, to find out what the whole universe looks like today is very hard. But we have this picture of the universe around us. That's the present-day universe. And we think that that's pretty normal. So we assume that the chunk of universe we've got in Sloan, the million galaxies around us, pretty much look like any other million galaxies in the universe. And so we've got a chunk of the present-day universe, and we assume that that's carried out throughout the whole thing. I hope that sort of answers your question.
Does it answer?
Oh, well, in part it does, but there's stuff out there 13 billion years,
mm-hmm.
light years away, that there's no way it looks like
right. What's
around here.
Right, but we assume that, I mean, it won't look exactly the same. There's unlikely to be, I have to tell you, there's unlikely to be a Wisconsin on a planet called Earth in one of those galaxies today. But, you know, if you took that patch of the universe that we see as it was 13 billion years ago, by now, it probably has galaxies, it probably has big clusters of galaxies, just like we do. It has a mix of ellipticals and spirals, there are stars that have formed there. So, I mean, the processes that gave us our bit of the universe will have happened over there as well. And so we can assume that it's sort of gone the same way. It's a bit like, you know, if I look at my grandparents, you know, I know that I can imagine what they were like when they were young. Because I see other young people around. So you can piece together the history of a human by looking at people at lots of different ages. And that's what we do with the universe. So the assumption is that all the way over there, it'll look much the same as the bit of the universe we're in today.
And what's the site you go to every day, Alan?
Astronomy Picture of the Day.
Astronomy Picture of the Day.
It's a fantastic website.
That's great.
Look at today's. It's got beautiful sun rays over Lake Michigan. So
wonderful.
Take a look at today's.
I sure will. Yeah.
Is it safe to say that quasars are extinct?
So quasars are active galaxies. They're galaxies with black holes in the center, which are feeding, and they're messily feeding, so they give out huge amounts of light. They're not extinct. They're less common than they used to be, but we're beginning to think that all galaxies go through phases where their black holes are feeding, and we see them as these incredibly bright objects. So even the Milky Way might have been active sometime in the past, and there are still quasars around today.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Alan, for your call. We enjoyed hearing from you. Jay in Wautoma, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Jay.
I have a question about a theory that I've heard a while ago, that the universe has no center and it has no edge. Is
sure.
that true?
We think so. And it's incredibly difficult to get your head around this.
Yes.
I keep saying that, which it sounds like I'm being rude, but I'm not. I mean, my co-host on Sky at Night, Patrick Moore, who's been presenting the thing since 1957, knows that this is impossible to get your head around, because he asked Einstein whether Einstein could see what this universe looked like, and even Einstein couldn't. It doesn't have a center, though, because we think that it began in a Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. And incidentally, we know that number more accurately than we know the age of the Earth, which is something that
really
just blows my mind.
Yes.
But we think that the universe began in the Big Bang, and everything we see was in or close to a single point back then. So we were all in the same place. And so it doesn't really make sense to point at a galaxy and say that's the center of the universe, because we were all back there. We were all in the same place. And so that's why it doesn't have a center. Whether it has an edge or not, you can imagine it having a size. So we predict that it's very, very, very big, but it has a physical size. You could measure it, but if you travel headed off in one direction, the odds are that you would never actually reach an edge. Just as if I head south from here, I don't reach the edge of the Earth. I just go round and round, if that makes any sense. Big thoughts for Wednesday
yes.
morning, Emma.
I love them, though. Very
That's
big thoughts.
Big thought. And I have one other question.
Mm-hmm. So
what is explain to me about Pluto, because I kind of lost that. At first it was a planet, and now it's not.
Sure. Well, the important thing is that nothing changed for Pluto. It doesn't care. But what happened was we started to discover lots of other Pluto-sized things out in the outer solar system. And the idea is that basically the solar system didn't get its act together out there, and it never formed a big planet. It just formed lots of rubble. And so there were lots of small things and lots of Pluto-sized things. So we had a choice as astronomers. We could either declare that we'd found more planets, which would be fine, but then we'd quickly end up with a few thousand planets, I think, in the next 20 years. And that's a lot of names to learn. So, excuse me. So instead, we decided to put a limit on what a planet was that excluded Pluto. So it has its friends out there. We call them dwarf planets or even Plutinos, which are small Plutos. And then there are the eight main planets. But we're going to learn. You're going to hear a lot about Pluto in the next few years because there's a spacecraft on the way there called New Horizons.
Oh,
it's just over halfway. It's been traveling for most of a decade already.
Oh my!
But it's going to go to Pluto, and we'll get our first proper look.
Huh. That's pretty exciting.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Hey. Well, that's like you can expand. You can expand your explorations beyond Pluto, and you're going to pick up, what you call the small.
That's
Pluto
right. Yeah, and New Horizons is going to go on to. It's going to fly by Pluto. It can't stop. It doesn't have the ability to do that. So it'll fly by. I've just looked up the date, by the way. It's going to arrive on July the 14th, 2015. So mark your diaries. But it's going to go on to one of these other objects. But it will probably go on to something that hasn't been discovered yet. So they're looking right now for objects out there that will be interesting that it could easily get to. And it'll be wonderful to see how unusual Pluto actually is.
Thank you very much for the call, Jay. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Chris Lintott is our guest, co-founder of the Galaxy Zoo, co-author of Bang, The Complete History of the Universe. And we're talking about the Galaxy Zoo project, which you're invited to become a participant in if you would like, and looking also at issues of the galaxies this hour. 800-486-8655, or email is talk@wpr.org. You know, when you say, talking about things that blow your mind, when you talked about all of the galaxies that there are, 100 billion galaxies, and what has to come to mind is, what's the point? Why?
Why are there that many galaxies?
Right.
Oh, it's so that we could have astronomers. I think that's pretty clear. or at least that's the answer that my colleagues and I like to give. It's very difficult to answer that as a scientific question. I mean, we scientists are people who never quite stop asking how. Why comes later. So the questions I'm interested in are about how those galaxies formed and why we have 100 billion and not 3 or not a billion. Yeah, exactly. So and why did we get the mix that we see today? So one of the aims of Galaxy Zoo is to work out why we see these big giant ellipticals in clusters, why we live in a spiral galaxy, why this galaxy that you talked about from Hubble earlier, this beautiful image, it has an incredibly complicated shape. So why is that? And how did it get to be that way? And what does that tell us about the galaxy? So maybe that's slightly more mundane than why did the universe pop into existence, but at least I can get my head around those questions on a random morning.
And the picture that Hubble gives us, what's the classification of that galaxy? What kind is it?
Well, let me take a look. So one of the things that comes up is that you get different levels of classification. So this is an interesting one. So it's clearly a spiral galaxy. It has these beautiful spiral arms, and actually they're quite wispy further out. But there's a galaxy that looks like it's colliding with the main galaxy. Now, is that actually a collision? It's a bit difficult to tell. It may just be in the way. But if that's a collision, then what will happen is these galaxies will dance together, and the stars won't collide, but their gas will, and we'll get a huge burst of star formation. And this may settle down in 10, 100 million years to be a nice, boring elliptical. So you should enjoy these beautiful spiral arms while you can. One of the key things you can see here is that the color, whenever you look at any astronomical image, I know many of your listeners probably have a picture of a galaxy in their mind that they've seen in the paper or online. When you see blue in an astronomical object, those are young stars. So where you see blue stars, you know that they formed in the last 100 million years or so. So that's a trace of what's going on recently in the galaxy. And this galaxy has beautiful blue spiral arms.
Hmm.
So there are stars forming in there.
Hmm. Karen in Platteville, hi.
Hi. This is a question that's been I've been wondering about for almost 50 years.
Oh, my.
This is going to be a difficult one.
Where did nothing come from, and where did something come from? Is nothing just a human concept, or did something arrive from nothing, or did nothing arrive from something, or is there something in between? Just that whole concept.
This is tricky.
Very tricky.
I'm sure you'll be wondering about it for the next 50 years. But let me say something about what we can say. Because this is something I think that people often misunderstand about what we do and don't understand when we say the word Big Bang. So there's really, really, really solid evidence that everything in the universe was in a very compact, hot state 13.7 billion years ago. So everything we can see was in a space much less than the top of the eye of a needle. And we have evidence for that. So, I mean, I'm not sure you want me to give the 24-hour lecture course, but we can make predictions. If we assume that, we can make predictions that we can test in the universe today. If you go much further back before that, then we start to get into tricky territory. At first, you end up in theory, and my theoretical colleagues can tell you with some degree of confidence what the universe was like, something like a billion, billion, billionth of a second after what you might call the Big Bang. But we don't understand why the Big Bang happened. We don't understand that point at time equals zero. Maybe that was truly the beginning. Maybe there was some physics before then that we didn't understand. And there's a whole, you can imagine a whole history of the universe before that point that we don't yet understand, and we don't have an easy way of testing. And so one answer to your question about how did something come out of nothing is that maybe it didn't. Maybe there's more physics and a much longer history of space and of the universe before that point. But the details aren't clear to us yet. In fact, even the broad outline isn't clear. But I wouldn't be surprised if when theory advances and we can find new ways to make observations, that you'll find that isn't what happened, that there wasn't this sudden springing of something out of nothing. But in fact, maybe there was a much longer eternal history of a universe stretching back.
Ooh, it's fascinating.
That's the world's longest cop-out answer, by the way.
It's good.
So I think I just walked around your question.
It was good. It was a good answer.
Hopefully it'll help you sleep at night.
An email from Susie in London. My understanding of light-time physics is somewhat hazy. Is it possible that some of the light currently reaching us from elsewhere in the universe was actually emitted by our own galaxy when it was in a different place billions of years ago?
Well, it depends on the size of the universe. So go back to thinking about walking around the Earth. So if I start walking south after, I don't know, maybe a decade or so, I'd end up back here in Tucson. I probably need to get over oceans and so on, but ignore that for now. But if the Earth was a billion times bigger than it is, then if I start walking south, I'd need to walk for many, many billions of lifetimes before I come back round. And so whether we see light echoing around the universe in the way you describe depends on how big the universe is. And people have actually looked for this. There have been experiments to look for repeated patterns in the universe. And the conclusion is that we live in a pretty big universe, and so there hasn't been time for light to travel around again and show us our galaxy as it was in the past.
Hmm. We go next to Dan from Iron Ridge, Wisconsin. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Two questions, and then I'll hang up and let you answer. First one is, what are the majors you expect with the new telescope that they launched as far as how far you can see, and what was the main, what was the main objective for launching that?
Okay.
And also,
which
what kind
telescope
of materials
do you think
you'll find in our other universes compared to what we have here?
All right. I think Chris had a question for you. He's trying to make this more specific. What, Chris?
I just wondered if you had a, because there have been several recent space telescopes, so I can pick my favorite, but if there was one you had in mind, then...
Well, I know there's one launched in 09.
In 09, okay. So
yeah,
I think
that I didn't know about. I don't know if that's is that a telescope that's basically for viewing?
Yeah, so there were three. I watched two of them go up from the launch site down in French Guiana, which was an amazing experience from deep in the jungle. So one of them is called Herschel. And Herschel is the largest telescope in space. It's bigger than Hubble, but it has a different mission. It doesn't look at the light that our eyes can see. It looks at long wavelength light, so the very far infrared. And that means it can look at the cold stuff in the universe. And so one of its purposes is to look at the places where stars are forming and to really get a proper glimpse at the nurseries of stars like our own sun, because we actually understand relatively little about star formation. We know the basic process. We know that gas and dust collapses to form to a point where nuclear reactions can begin and a star forms, but we don't understand the details at all. So Herschel's doing that. The other exciting one, the American telescope that was launched just a year or so ago, in fact, maybe slightly longer than that now, is called Kepler. And Kepler is a machine for detecting planets around other stars. And we have every confidence that Kepler will find Earth-sized planets orbiting stars other than our own sun. And some of those will be in such a place that they could have liquid water on their surface. So I think I'm maybe two years away from being able to point at a star in the night sky and tell you that it has an Earth-like planet orbiting it, and then we're 10 years away from being able to point at it and say whether it has an atmosphere like our own. I think that this is the most stunning area of astrophysics at the minute, that we can talk about worlds other than our own.
It sure is. And then, so we're equally as far away from determining if there might be somebody, something like us, maybe a little bit of
Yeah, you're after a bigger audience again, aren't you? They're probably listening. But no, I mean, looking for intelligence is one thing, and that's a very hard problem. It's much worse than looking for a needle in all the haystacks in the world. But I think where we will go with the next generation of really big telescopes is if we find these Earths and we can look at their atmosphere, that atmosphere might have clues as to whether there's life there or not. So, for example, on Earth, we only have oxygen in our atmosphere because of the efforts of many, many billions of bacteria that produced oxygen something like 600 million years ago. So if we're able to, and if you killed life on Earth, all life on Earth right now, that oxygen would very quickly disappear from the atmosphere. It would get locked up in chemical reactions with rocks and so on. And so if we looked at one of these, I think we're 10 years from looking at a planet and knowing it has oxygen in the atmosphere and knowing that that oxygen must have come from biological processes.
That's astounding.
We find one of those, I think that changes, you know, that will be one of the greatest discoveries of all time.
Yes, it certainly will. And where will you be on that day?
Oh, I'll be glued to a computer like everybody else, I suspect. Wait, because it will just be an announcement. Mm-hmm. First, though, we need the next generation of telescopes, and there are these enormous plans for telescopes with mirrors that are 30 meters across, or maybe even bigger than that. And that's what we need to see these planets, because mm-hmm. they're a long way away and they're pretty close to their stars. So mm-hmm. we have to pick them out.
Thanks, Dan. Michelle in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I've been reading this book called What on Earth Happened, and it talks about a theory in it that it's possible to have more than one universe. And if the universe is constantly expanding because we can measure that the planets are moving farther away, is it possible for the universe to contract?
Yes, it is. It's very possible for the universe to contract. In fact, that was a leading theory for a long while. It depends on how much stuff there is in the universe. because until recently, the only force astronomers worried about was gravity. And gravity pulls things together. We know this because I'm standing on the Earth. And so if you have lots of stuff, then gravity can actually slow down the expansion of the universe. And if there's enough stuff, it can actually reverse it. And people talked about the opposite of a Big Bang, which is a big crunch as you pull everything together. And people even asserted that you could have that would rebound, and then you don't need to explain the Big Bang because you have this bouncing universe that goes, expands, and then contracts, and expands and contracts. The problem recently is that there's a bit of a fly in that particular ointment because we've discovered another force. We give it the terrible name dark energy. It doesn't mean anything. It's something we don't understand. But we actually found out that the universe is accelerating, so the expansion is speeding up. And we don't understand why this is, and we don't understand what force is driving that. But it seems to, at least for now, our universe isn't going to contract. I should say, by the way, that the numbers I've been talking about, the 100 billion galaxies, that's just our observable universe. That's the bit of the universe we can see. And most scientists would believe that the actual universe is much, much bigger than that.
Ooh.
So we have an even grander stage out there to think about.
Hmm. Thanks, Michelle, for the call. Here's an email from Dwayne. Is the moon hollow? History Channel's ancient astronauts have a theory that the moon's craters are bottomless. The moon is hollow, and it can ring like a bell. Is this poppycock?
I'm afraid it is. I good use of the word poppycock as well, so that's excellent. But no, we know that the moon isn't hollow because we know how much stuff there is. When we put satellites in orbit around it, then we can work out how much the moon weighs, and we know that it's not hollow. The moons of Mars, which are small asteroids, there's something very odd going on with them. They're very light, and so one possibility is that they have Phobos, one of the moons of Mars, may be hollow, but our moon's a nice, solid, proper. It's really almost a planet, and it has an internal structure that we're trying to understand as well, just like the Earth does.
Eric in West Salem, hi.
Good morning. A fantastic program. Ironically, my questions also involve the moon. The first one, can you explain why the moon, unlike other planets, does not spin, and that we always see always the same side of the moon, or why it doesn't vary, even if it was in a fixed orbit the way it is? And then secondly, the things that have been left on the moon, like the LEM lander, the flag, and the different things that have been left there, are these things in positions where they can be seen from the Earth with a telescope? And I guess that's the extent of my questions.
Okay. Well, the first one is easy to answer because the moon used to spin a few billion years ago. But what happens is, as we know, the moon raises tides on the Earth. So you see the seawater going up and down because it's pulled by the moon. But that causes friction, believe it or not. And so that slows down the moon's rotation. And so after a while, it becomes what we call tidally locked. And so it slows down its spin so that it actually rotates. The moon is spinning, but it rotates once in the time it takes to go around the Earth. And so it's locked to our planet. So it's almost... As it orbits us, then it keeps it. It's very shy. It keeps its same face. It turns, so it keeps the same face pointed towards us. So that's that one. And the other question was about seeing the artifacts that have been left there by the space race. You can't see them from Earth. They're far too small. But the satellite that provided the images for my Moon Zoo project, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, has taken some incredible pictures of the Apollo landing site. So not only can you see the landing modules and some of the other things that have been left, you can actually see the tracks left by the astronauts, so you can retrace their steps. You can't see the individual footprints, but you can actually see the marks that they left on the moon. And those images, I think, are absolutely stunning.
Mm. And thanks so much for the call. We need to pause for a moment. We'll continue our conversation with Chris Lintott. He is co-founder of the Galaxy Zoo and co-author of Bang, the Complete History of the Universe. if you go to London or England, you'll see him on BBC as well, where he is a co-presenter of a television program that's been on the air for 50 years, the Sky at Night program, where he's alongside Sir Patrick Moore. He also has a regular column on observing the night sky in the Times. 800-486-8655. If you want to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org. We'll make sure, if you want to get your pencils and paper ready, we'll give you some valuable email addresses. One is how you can become involved in the project that we've been talking about, which would be a nice thing to do, right, to help classify galaxies. Good school project as well. And also our Facebook page will have, we've been talking a lot about this picture from Hubble yesterday, just to give you an example of what a galaxy picture looks like. This one is it needs a better name, NGC 4911, galaxy 320 million light years away. And it's a beautiful picture. It was just released yesterday morning. So we'll put that on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls now. Let's go to Bob in Eau Claire. Hi, Bob. Hello, Bob.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Tonight is the Perseid meteor shower, or the peak of the shower. And I understand that what we're doing as we are orbiting the sun is that we go through the field of, I think it's the Temple Tuttle comet that went through here several years ago. And I've never been able to quite figure out how we keep finding new material to produce these meteors year after year when the comet has been long gone for how many years ago it came through the solar system. Do you have an explanation for that?
Sure, and you're my favorite person because I've been looking for an excuse to talk about the Perseid.
Oh, great, so, great.
So the peak this year, actually, it's normally on the 11th, but this year it's actually tomorrow night. You will see shooting stars if you go out tonight, but tomorrow night, either side of midnight, is the best time for people over in the U.S. to take a look. So find yourself a dark site. Look towards the northwest or the southeast, and just sit back and enjoy the show. We might get as many as 60 to 100 shooting stars an hour from a dark site. And even in a light-polluted city, you should see 10 or so. So the Perseids are fantastic. And you're right that they're caused when material that's left from comet Swift-Tuttle hits the Earth's atmosphere. And each one is probably the size of a grain of sand, if that. But they burn up in the Earth's atmosphere and produce these spectacular meteors. There's material left because the material spreads out around the comet's orbit. So the comet comes through the solar system. I think it's every 70 or so years. The last pass was 1992. And it sheds material. And that material gets distributed right around the comet's orbit. And it's been through the inner solar system many, many, many times. And so there's quite a lot of material there. And we just pass through a different part of it each year. One of the reasons that it's so hard to predict exactly how many meteors we're going to get is that we don't know where the biggest clumps of material are. So we don't quite know when we're going to hit a nice, juicy, dense patch and when we're going to pass through just the leftovers. So when the comet's nearby, we do see more meteors. So for about 6 or 7 years after 1992, which is the last time it visited, we saw more Perseids than we would otherwise. But there'll be plenty over the next couple of nights, and hopefully the weather will be good and people can get out and see them.
Anything more, Bob?
No, that's great. Thank you so much.
My
Thanks,
pleasure.
Bob. Mm-hmm. Benjamin in Minneapolis. Hi. Hello, Benjamin. Benjamin is not there. Paul in Clintonville. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. I have a question, but it's kind of stands on the end of cosmology, I guess, and certainly, if this man doesn't want to even go into this, I can certainly understand it. I'll lay it out for you anyway. From a general point of view, speaking of astronomers as a whole group or category of people, how does the one God creationist type thing stand with that whole group of people? I mean, what's their view of God in the universe, if I'm permitted that? If not, don't worry about it.
Well, I think you'd just have to ask.
I'm happy to say something. I mean, the first thing to point out is that I don't speak for other astronomers,
right.
So I can give you my opinion. I see a distinct division between the scientific questions about how the universe is created and operates and the religious questions about God and about a purpose to the universe. And so, you know, I can say that there is excellent evidence that the universe was in a hot, dense state 13.7 billion years ago. I happen to be an atheist, and I have no idea what the religious implications of that statement are, but I absolutely don't think it's certainly very, very possible to be both a religious person and to accept the current scientific theories. And I know this because I was at a conference at the Vatican a few years ago, and the Vatican actually funds a lot of astrophysical research, and they're very friendly. So that's one example of how the two can coexist.
Hmm.
So hopefully that says something about what that sort of answers your question.
And here's an email that's come in along those lines from John in Eagle River. How do you answer people who believe only in the book of Genesis and not in evolution or your type of science and discovery?
Well, I would say that, you know, I believe very strongly that the scientific method is an excellent way of finding out about the world. And I believe that evolution is true. I'm no biologist, but I've spent a lot of time reading about it. And I believe in what I'm saying about the universe. I believe these are the things that we have the best evidence for.
Mm-hmm.
And where that contradicts the book of Genesis, if it contradicts the book of Genesis, or rather if it contradicts somebody's personal reading of Genesis, I would say that they're wrong. But that doesn't mean that everyone with a religious belief is wrong, and that doesn't mean that there's anything inherently contradictory between science and religion.
Thanks very much for the call. So were you a little kid who used to sit out in the backyard looking at the stars, and
Definitely.
That's what you were?
Definitely, yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, I, from about the age of 10, and then my school had had an observatory. And so I was... Unbelievably, they gave us the keys to it. And this was fantastic because I got to play with this enormous telescope to explore the universe. But it was also useful because they used to make us go on a cross-country run every week, and I used to hide in the observatory so that I didn't have to go on the full run. So astronomy can have many effects on your life, but at least one effect for me was that I didn't have to run in the wind and the rain.
Oh, Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I have a question. If you've ever heard of something called a Mercury Mirror Telescope, and the idea of it is you would get a container around, glass container of mercury, and put it on a precision-built turntable, something where you could vary the speed of it, and by turning this pool of mercury on a turntable, you could vary the focal length by varying the curvature of the pool of mercury with centrifugal force.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is an old idea, actually. People were talking about doing this back in the 19th century, and the advantage is that the most expensive part of a telescope, I think, is always the mirror. And the mirror has to be very carefully polished to make the correct shape. This is what went wrong with Hubble originally before they went and fixed it. But if you do the spinning mercury, then you can get your mirror perfectly formed very cheaply. And in fact, there are places where this is done. So out in British Columbia, about 40 miles east of Vancouver, there's a telescope called the Large Zenith Telescope, which has a 6-meter mercury mirror, which makes it one of the largest telescopes in the world. And it has a disadvantage. They don't do what you're talking about. They don't tilt it, so it can only look straight up. But if you've got a six meter mirror, you can see an awful lot wherever in the sky you look. And so they just wait for things, interesting things, to pass over. And I think that's an interesting technology. There are all sorts of clever ideas at the minute about making big telescopes cheaply, and I think this is something worth keeping an eye on.
I want to make sure we get all of our websites down here. If you would like to sign up to help you with your wonderful project, please give us that address again.
Sure, there are two. You can either go to galaxyzoo.org to get started with classifying
galaxyzoo.org.
That's it. Or if you're interested in the rest of the universe and you want to see some of our broader range of projects, that's zooniverse.org.
Z-O-O-N-I-V-E-R-S-E.
That's it. Yep. .org. Or just Google us. But I will be expecting a spike of traffic from Wisconsin, and we will check. So I'll be back on the phone if your listeners don't help us out.
Okay, zooniverse.org. Do it, everybody. You've got a great audience here, and you'll have a lot of fun and report back to us. Somebody also sent an email. Are you familiar with this, that Google has a Google Sky available?
Yeah, we've worked a bit with them. So that's a great way to explore what we can see in the universe.
Google Sky.
Yeah,
okay.
So you can just Google that. I don't need to give you the address for Google Sky.
Okay, great. And go to our website, go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Chrissy will put up this picture, this wonderful picture that you'll want to blow up and put. Oh, she already did. And you can blow it up and have it with you, and then you could talk about it all day long and imagine the world beyond this earth, and it will be a very unusual and exciting day. So you could do that. And Zooniverse, again, it's zooniverse.org. And Chris said they're going to be checking to see how many people from Wisconsin and beyond will be involved in helping them with their wonderful projects classifying universes. Oh, that's great. Oh, Chris, you were just terrific. Thank you so much.
Good questions there.
Yeah, they are good questions. And thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour.
My pleasure.
Good.
Talk to you again soon.
Oh, good. I hope so. Chris Lintott, co-founder of the Galaxy Zoo, co-author of Bang, the Complete History of the Universe. Thanks, Rhonda Fanning, for producing. Chrissy Pease for on-air production. And thanks for listening.